and welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig here on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I believe you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. You can also listen to this show. If you're listening, you already know somehow, but you can also listen online at kpft.org. And this is a call-in show, so a little later in the show, we will be taking phone calls at 713-526-5738. My engineer and partner here is Egberto Willis. My blog is thinkwingradio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio. Okay, so now that we've gotten that stuff out of the way, I think we're going to have kind of an interesting show today on a couple of different levels, both on the specific facts that we're going to be talking about and on some of the implications that we're going to talk about later. I think a fair introduction for the topic of this show was written at the time, contemporaneously, by Whitney Radley at the time for the HoustonCultureMap.com website on December 11th, 2011, entitled Showdown at the Port, Occupy Houston Protesters Block Traffic with Their Bodies, Clash with Police. And the story goes like this. In conjunction with the West Coast port shutdown and in solidarity with similar movements from Houston to Honolulu, Occupy Houston and representatives from occupations in Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio took on the Port of Houston Authority on Monday, December 11, 2011, in the afternoon. By the end of the protest, 25 occupiers were arrested. The story goes on that the Day of Action was conceived as an effort to support the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the California truck drivers attempting to form a labor union. Though the blue-collar port jobs seem a far cry from the suits and portfolios of Wall Street, occupiers also considered the port protest, quote, a statement against the multinational conglomerates and their relentless campaign to outsource American jobs and undermine our economy in the pursuit of ever-widening profits. I've got links to a lot of these things on the show announcement on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, and I think you might want to dig a little more deeply into it. But to go on, that's the end of the quote from that article. 25 protesters were arrested that day. But for seven of them, their legal nightmare had just begun. My guest tonight is Ronnie Garza, who is on Twitter as @SurveillanceI, an Austin occupier and a social and political activist. He was one of those so-called Gulfport Seven, and tonight we will discuss his story. Some of the questions we'll be exploring: were the protesters entrapped? Were the Gulfport Seven actually collateral damage from a political spat between Houston and Austin? When is law enforcement surveillance and or infiltration of a group justified, if ever? What do news consumers do when the mainstream media fails them, and when alternative media becomes your only source? How do you evaluate it for objectivity and accuracy? So tonight, my guest is Ronnie Garza, and we'll be talking about this. And after he tells his story, we will take questions and comments at 713-526-5738. So how you doing tonight, Ronnie?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Mike? Can you hear me?
Yeah, great connection. Thank you so much. So you heard my intro. Do you want to kind of tell your story, and then we can go into some questions and details and extrapolations?
Sure. Okay. So thanks for the introduction. My name is Ronnie Garza, and I live in Austin. I was part of Occupy Austin. I'm originally from the Valley, from Brownsville, McAllen, and I actually wasn't very political until about 2008, 2009, but then through good alternative media, stuff like Democracy Now! And Better Stuff Online, I started learning a lot more about history of the United States, history of the world, and it was kind of a culture shock from what I'd been exposed to in the past, so I knew that I had to get active, and that's the reason I moved to Austin. I moved to Austin to get active and learn more. So I got here about 2010, and Occupy started around 2011. And so I jumped in with both feet as soon as it started. I didn't have a job at the moment, and I had never seen anything like it before. So I just try to go all out. And part of what I was doing with Occupy was something called InterOccupy, and that was basically a way to coordinate between the cities and try and do national days of action, that sort of thing. And that's really how I got involved with the port action. The call had come out from Oakland to support the longshoremen out there on the West Coast, and they were doing a port shutdown, and they were asking other folks to join in on solidarity actions, basically to raise the profile of what they were doing out there. So originally, we were actually going to go to New Braunfels. There was an alternate idea that was floated around for landlocked cities to block a distribution center. But over time, once we started realizing that folks in Dallas and San Antonio and Houston were interested in actually doing something out at the port in Houston, we went out there. We knew that the port was massive, and we weren't going to be able to shut it down in any way. So we did a solidarity action, a symbolic action. We blocked this roadway that was going out to the main entrance out at the port. So we get out there, and there's a ton of cops, and there was a ton of occupiers, and about 20 plus of us got arrested, and 7 of us got arrested and charged with these felonies.
Now, I'm just going to interrupt here for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes during these protests, there is actually some agreement between the protesters and the police in advance that, yes, there are going to be some civil disobedience arrests, and you might have several people actually volunteer to be arrested, and it's all processed relatively smoothly. Was there anything like that here, any kind of pre-notice or cooperation in advance between the protesters and any authorities?
Not that I'm aware of. Nothing in terms of this is our game plan, but the park was pretty open, so there were some cops kind of milling about, and they knew that people were going to be coming out. So later on, we realized they knew exactly what to expect, but we didn't really sort of telegraph it to them. So we just went out there. So we get out there, and we lay down with the pipes, and other folks just lay down locking arms.
Okay, I think you probably need to go into a little bit more detail, because this is kind of a crucial part of the story. You had about a half a dozen of you, I guess 7 of you, who were linked together with chains and locks of a sort, and you had your arms and the chains and locks inside some wide-diameter PVC pipe, the whole point of which was to make this take as long as possible for them to disconnect you guys and arrest you.
Right, exactly. And this is a fairly common tactic in past protests. There was even one a couple of days ago here in town, an immigration-related protest out at the county courthouse, or at the jail, and they were locked arms with the same devices. So this is something that's been going on for a while. The tar sands blockaders are using the same sort of tactics, and so it was just a way to slow down the arrest, to delay it as long as possible. And so they came out, and if you can see a bunch of videos online, but they brought out this big red tent. The fire department had this big red inflatable tent that they actually used to do the arrests of everyone out in the street.
Now, when you say to do the arrests, if I recall correctly, and you can correct me, it was not just a matter of they brought out the tent to process people. I seem to recall that they had actually covered up you guys so that the media couldn't photograph or see how they were working to disconnect you, essentially to try to take some of the sting out of the protest. Am I remembering that right?
No, that's exactly
okay.
Right.
Okay.
So no one was able to see how they were arresting us, how they were separating us. And one of the guys, they were trying to get him to let go from another person who was locked arms, and they were kind of going at his nose, trying to get some sort of pressure point going into induce some pain to get them to let go, but shortly thereafter they decided to bring out that tent and do all the arrests and the dismantling under the tent. So that's kind of how our arrests went. I've never really seen that before. Since I did see it one time out of the tar sands, a small green tent was used one time with somebody who was locking down, but I've never really seen that before. So anyways, they do the arrests. And then we go in. We spend a couple of days in jail until we finally get processed out. And then we go and we see the judge. And the judge had never heard of the charge. She was looking through the book as we were standing in front of her.
What was the specific charge she had never heard of?
So the charge was manufacture or use of a criminal instrument. And this charge goes back to the 70s. It was actually originally an obscenity charge, and it was a felony. Basically, back in the 70s, the Dallas DA was trying to shut down these porno theaters, and they were throwing misdemeanors at them. And eventually, they decided they're going to start using felonies and call the projectors a criminal instrument. And that's the origin of this actual charge. So she was trying to search for how it matched up with what we were doing, and at the time she couldn't see it.
Yeah, you obviously weren't using projectors.
No probable cause.
I'm sorry, I was just saying you obviously didn't use projectors, so that couldn't have been the issue.
Yeah. Well, there's a few kind of like requirements, about three or four specific requirements for it to be applied, and she couldn't see that it matched any of those requirements, so she threw it out. But the district attorney in Houston decided to go ahead and take it to the grand jury about a week later, and they reindicted us. So that set off a chain of events that lasted about 14 months, somewhere around there. And during that time, one of the seven of us actually was spending the whole time in jail. So he spent about a year and a half in jail, Eric Marquez.
He wasn't able
to make
bail.
And his whole story is pretty incredible itself. Go ahead.
He wasn't able to make bail.
Well, he wasn't offered bail at the beginning.
Really?
Yeah, Eric's story is pretty complicated. He was a veteran. He was a veteran of the war in Iraq. He had PTSD, and when he got out, he stole a car, or he grabbed a car at some point shortly after he got out of the Army, and the police picked him up, and he had this old charge on him. And so because of that, he wasn't able to make bail for several months. And then they put it at 50 grand, something like that. And later on, they dropped it down. But yeah, it's pretty complicated as to what exactly happened to him.
He had his own legal issues to deal with.
Yeah, and I can kind of go through that a little bit here at the end. But it is a very complicated story, and that's why it's part of the reason why I'm doing the documentary. But so anyways, we get reindicted, and at that point, my attorney, Greg Gladden, who's working with the NLG, National Lawyers Guild, he was just preparing to fight the charge on its face.
Now, just tell us really quickly, the National Lawyers Guild is what, a public service, like pro bono legal organization?
Well, it's not a pro bono legal organization, but it is sort of like a progressive legal kind of coalition of lawyers who are interested in specific types of cases, especially involving civil liberties and that sort of thing. He used to be the past president of the Texas ACLU here in Texas.
Okay, so he took the case.
Similar. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So Greg Gladden took your case.
Mm-hmm. So he took on the case, and we were preparing just to fight it on face value, just the charge itself. But he knew right away to sort of suspect some extra kind of malfeasance, and so he asked the district attorney in Houston right away, as soon as we were back in court, if there was an agent provocateur of some sort, if he could provide any other information. And they said, well, no, we don't know anything about anything like that. So, just get ready for trial, basically. So we worked on it. And he told me to keep my ears open in case there was anything that kind of came across on our side, or if anybody knew anything about a provocateur. At the time, I didn't know anything. But what happened is the Occupy Austin inbox, like our basic email inbox, got a tip-off from a person who lives in the city. And basically, this person had gone out on a double date with one of the undercover detectives, a person named Shannon Dowell. But he didn't give us the full name. He basically laid it out that he went out on this to this dinner date with his wife and his wife's sister-in-law and an old friend from high school, and his name was Shannon, and he had this big beard, and he was involved in this port action. And so from the description, from the physical description, we knew right away who it was. But we didn't have any real specific evidence linking it back to the Austin Police Department. We didn't have a full name. We didn't have anything like that.
Hold on 1 second. I need to do a quick station ID. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, and this is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. Okay, I'm sorry to have interrupted. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. So we get this tip off, this email tip off, but we don't have the sort of definitive way of proving it. So this took a while. This took a couple of months of digging around, and it was me. I dug around online. I basically constructed this large family tree based on the sender of the email and the people who were involved in the double date, and found a high school that looked like it might be the one that was the common high school. And so after weeks and weeks of digging through and constructing this huge family tree, I finally found that this high school had their high school yearbook photos online. And so I dug through those photos, and I was looking for a boy named Shannon, basically. And I found one. And I found the whole crew, basically, of people that I had been looking up. I saw people in all sorts of different grades that were matching the folks that I was looking at. And lo and behold, it was a guy named Shannon Dowell, about 7th grade, 8th grade picture. And so I used the Texas Tribune, which keeps really good government employee records. And I searched that database and found out that he was a detective with the Austin Police Department. So once we had that information, I gave it over to Greg, and he got a subpoena out for Shannon, and they got him into court. And this was really at the last moment. They wanted to take us to trial on September the 17th, 2012, which was going to be the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And it was like August that we actually got the subpoena. We got Shannon into court. So Shannon shows up and admits the whole thing. You know, he lays it on the line, saying, "Yes, I was there. I was involved and constructed these lock boxes, the very lock boxes that we used out at the protest
that earned you the felony charge."
Exactly. He manufactured
the criminal instrument. That's kind of the punchline here.
Exactly. Because it was him, and we find out later on it was him and two other undercover officers who did it.
You didn't know how, did you?
What was that?
You didn't know how to manufacture these things, did you?
No. The schematics were provided by the Austin Police Department. We even have emails where they ask up the chain of command if they can provide schematics to us.
And this is where surveillance and infiltration become really, really tricky, because when is it surveillance and when is it entrapment?
Right.
So this is a place you're going to get to.
Mm-hmm. So Shannon comes into court, lays it on the line, but doesn't really give a lot of details. In fact, he didn't respond to the subpoena. He told the judge that he dropped his thumb drive in the gutter on the way to court, and he had basically one page of notes from a meeting that he had gone to. But he was kind of spilling the beans a little bit as to what his chain of command was. He said it went up to the chief of police, and he said he was operating under an intelligence unit, which turned out to be the Fusion Center here in town.
Explain what the Fusion Center is.
So the Fusion Center is this. There's a bunch of Fusion Centers around the nation, and they were created after 9/11. And basically, they were created as a way for various departments to share information: fire department, police department, sheriff department, the various policing, law enforcement departments, they are able to network their information and respond supposedly to terrorist activity.
So this is essentially the kind of organization that most people say, yeah, we should have that because you shouldn't have a state database where a guy can go and he can be a serial killer and no one has a record of him. So we really should have these things. That's essentially what Fusion is.
Well, it's a way to share information, and its directive, because it got a lot of money from the Department of Homeland Security, is about terrorism. But I think they use it in a lot of different ways. I think it's always important to have good information sharing, but their directive seems to be very, very different than monitoring protests, which is exactly what was happening in this case, and we find out later on once they cough up the emails. That the Fusion Center was heavily involved. Now, we thought at that time that the case was over, actually. We thought that the Austin Police Department wasn't going to give up the names of the other two undercover officers that were involved, but and they didn't want to. But the DA in Houston wanted to proceed with the trial anyways. They had the opportunity, and the judge laid it out on the line and said, you can drop this and it'll go away and we don't have to go any further. And the DA in Austin was basically shaking their head going like, yes, we'd like to do that, but we're going to leave it up to Houston. So Houston, over and above Austin, decided to reveal the information, to put out the emails, to give out the names of the two undercovers. And we find out in those emails it was actually six undercover detectives were involved in Occupy Austin. Only three were involved in this particular action, but six in total had infiltrated from the past. Later on, we found the name of a fourth person through some other records, but we find out then at this point that the names of the undercovers were Shannon Dow, Deke Moore, and Rick Reza. Those were the three that we were given by the court, and later on we found that there was a fourth one named Shane Woodward, who had attended meetings with Dow and Moore as early as October the 3rd. It was actually before we had an encampment. They were already infiltrating.
All of these guys had nom de guerres?
Yeah. So Shannon was Butch, and Deke was Dirk. And Rick was Rick.
Oh, that's creative.
Yeah, it worked out. and Shane,
that's
I don't
what's
know.
Known as a poor alias.
Right. So we get this ton of emails eventually, about 300 pages of emails, pictures of them making the pipes, not just making the pipes, but showing off with the pipes, kind of like posing with the pipes. And there's a bunch of pictures online on our website that show what they were doing, but we get all this other text information, email information, and kind of a sense of what was going on the ground, and it was, you know, extra creepy kind of learning after the fact that the Deke specifically he was in a vice. Human trafficking unit, and he had actually been working with organizers, like grassroots organizers in the past related to human trafficking.
Above board. In other words, actually working with people to prevent human trafficking above board.
Right, exactly. And this was before Occupy, but he had been working with organizers and activists in that specific field in the past. So he had a really good kind of foot in to get some human intelligence, on the ground intelligence as to like who's doing what and who to talk to and who to avoid and all the rest. And that's really some of the most interesting aspects of the story, because I mean they were with us for a really long time. Like I said, before the actual encampment started, we had our camp set up on October the 6th, and they were there as early as October the 3rd.
I have a question that I think is probably of interest to all peaceful demonstrators. In hindsight, was there anything about these guys that would have clued you in if you had been paying attention? In hindsight.
Well, you know, it's hard because you're dealing with a whole lot of folks, but once we knew who they were, people knew right away who those people were, because there were some of the folks who were all about getting and doing action. They wanted to stop talking and get busy and do some sort of action.
Which is just the reverse of what passive surveillance ought to be.
Right. Exactly. And they were out there during a march that happened right before our eviction, and they had brought a backpack full of bricks. And they were saying, you know, we're ready, you know, in case you wanna like up the stakes, or I don't know exactly what they were saying to some of the folks in the march, but they were ready to hand over bricks to people to, I guess, what, throw through a window or something like that. None of that ever happened because the Austin occupation was extremely peaceful from the beginning. But they were just ready and waiting. And they scooped up a bunch of people over in Houston. So we find out that they had been infiltrating from the very beginning. They'd been going to our planning meetings, and they pretty much ran with the idea of these lock boxes. They provided the schematics, and then they met at Fusion to talk about it, at the Fusion Center here in town to talk about it, and then they went out to the store and they purchased the materials and they assembled them all and then just dropped them off. But that's one of the parts of the story that gets really kind of weird and tricky, because then we don't know exactly what's going on in terms of safety. Later on, APD saying, well, we did this for your safety, and they kind of turn around and they can't understand if it's a rogue operation or if they were doing it for our safety. But there's really no communication that we can see that explains to the Houston Police Department how to deal with these boxes. And if they just drop them off and let them go, then they let those materials just go. There was no eyes on the boxes up to the point where Houston was going to receive them. So any manner of, like, if we wanted to be bad people and hurt the HPD, which is one of the claims by APDs, we might have put some razor blades or some other kind of foolishness inside the pipes. That was totally available to us. If we wanted to, but we weren't, because it was a peaceful protest. But they just let them go. So it becomes really tricky to understand what the logic behind keeping anyone safe was to just add these devices to the mix, because that's really all it seems that they did.
Was there an original,
put these devices in the mix?
I'm sorry. Was there an original plan before the police apparently suggested these particular devices? Did you folks have some other way that you were planning on barricading the port, different kinds of locks, different kinds of chains, different kinds of securing devices?
I mean, there was
or were
a
you just going to hold hands and
it.
Link arms?
There was a number of ideas thrown around. I think there was some talk of bales of hay at some point. There might have been talk of a U-Haul truck or something like that. There's a bunch of different ideas about how can you block a road.
But thank goodness for the Austin police to make this suggestion.
Right. You know, so at least they were there to really streamline the operation.
Yeah, these guys knew how to obstruct.
Yeah, in the text messages, they're laughing back and forth with each other, saying we're leading the action in New Braunfels. At that time, it was still at New Braunfels, but they're like, we're leading the action over there, and they were joking around about the fact that they were doing that. The texts are actually really interesting because they're pretty much mocking a number of different occupiers at different times. But so, anyways, we go on, we get this information, and we think we're going to trial. I mean, we think that's it. That they've given over all the information and they're preparing for a trial by jury. Not only that, but the judge who had thrown out the case, who was looking at it still, it came back to her court. She retired in the middle of her term, Judge Joan Campbell. She was set to keep on being the judge for a while, and she just up and retired. So we're going to get this completely new judge who's never seen the case before, and. We didn't know what to expect at all. All of a sudden, in February of 13, the Houston DA decides to drop it. A lot of shifting in the office was happening. I know that the district attorney herself left, and then a number of people under her kind of left. So it was sort of like a moving and shifting office. And at some point, the person who had it, Josh Fanko, he decided to just let it go.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me do a quick station ID and give out the phone number. You are listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. The show is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. My guest is Ronnie Garza. He is one of the so-called Gulfport Seven, having to do with a Port of Houston protest on December 12, 2011 by Occupy Houston as well as some other Occupy groups. And we're having a discussion, and I think we can take some phone calls now in the course of things. So if you would like to either ask questions or make comments, the phone number here is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Okay, Ronnie, you want to continue?
Sure. So so like I said, in February, Josh decided that he's going to offer us a plea deal, basically giving us misdemeanors, which we all thought that that's what we were going to get when we started that protest. And given the chances of things going wrong and the long string of ups and downs that we had in the preceding year, I was ready to jump at that, and so were a couple of other folks. And we had some long discussions about it, but we eventually all decided to go for it, take the deal, and cut our losses and move on and you know, live to fight another day, basically. So we took the deal of the misdemeanors, so we didn't have to deal with any jail time or felony charges or anything like that, and we were done, finally done. But Eric was still in jail, and that was part of it. That was really kind of pretty stressful and distressing. He was in there for a year and a half, something like that. We had gotten bail for him. After the judge found out about the undercover, she dropped the bail amount for Eric to $35,000. And so we raised a non-refundable $3,500, 10% of that, and gave it to the bondsman. And they processed the bond, and Eric was getting processed out of jail. He was changed out in his street clothes. And right before he was about to get out, he was a few feet from the door, right before they were going to cut off his tag. They said, "Oh, we found something else in the system." It turns out that the DA in Dallas, where Eric was from, he's from the Grapevine, Dallas area, decided to file charges as he was being bailed out. So that way he had to see a parole board up in Dallas for his old charge that he had, and they were saying, well, because he got arrested out of Houston, you know, he's obviously doing some bad stuff. But this charge that they used to get him up to Dallas went away. It was some sort of dispute. It was like a family dispute, and his grandmother didn't want to follow up. It was her. She got mad at some point at him and called the cops, but didn't want to follow up. She was upset. Didn't want to follow up, but it was the DA's discretion to go ahead and file those charges anyways. So they filed the charges. Once they got him to Dallas, they dropped those charges, but got him in front of a parole board in Houston for these old – they were basically saying, well, he violated the terms of his parole for these old charges. And so they gave him 4 years at that point. So he got out on good behavior before that amount of time, but it took a while before he was able to get out. So at this point, he's now out. He's in Austin now, and he's working, and he's trying to get back on his feet. The rest of us have moved on to other ventures and continuing protests and activities, and he's trying to get back to square one. And I'm doing a documentary basically on the story, because there's a lot of ins and outs and a lot of bits and pieces and details.
Yeah, this is the short version.
Right. Exactly. and it connects in numerous ways to the various other protesters who were arrested, like the NATO 3. Their trial just ended today. And they were entrapped as well. They had these two people called Mo and Gloves, and they were pretty forceful.
More creative than Rick.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great website, freethenato3.wordpress.com, that really details how that trial went, and they're finding a lot of information about how that entrapment happened over there. But these fusion centers are kind of a common denominator in terms of how information's gathered and it's done on the state level and the national level. So there's a lot of bits and pieces to how the surveillance happens, how it works, and the general crackdown and sort of pushback against Occupy and any kind of momentum that we had, they were trying to snuff it out just as much as humanly possible.
Okay,
I think this is really a victory for us. I think that we fought back and we won this time around. And so I think it's important to talk about that.
I think there's no question that Occupy succeeded to the extent of literally changing the direction of conversation in this country, politically, economically, socially. No question. I think many of us think it might have accomplished more if tactically or strategically Occupy had done some things differently or had done some different things. But I would absolutely not say that Occupy was a failure just because it seems to have faded into the background. It definitely had some serious and long-term successes. The phone number is 713-526-5738. If you have questions or comments for Ronnie or about anything that might be related to the Occupy movement, police surveillance, COINTELPRO, anything that might be obliquely of interest in this kind of a discussion, I welcome your phone call, 713-526-5738. In our prior conversations, Ronnie, we have discussed some other stuff that kind of begins to tie into this. I think one of the things we discussed in the context of the George Washington Bridge situation is, was this really all, at the end of the day, a spat between the government of Houston and the government of Austin or their police departments or their prosecutors' departments? Were you guys kind of collateral damage in Houston being ticked off that they didn't have appropriate information from Austin about what was going on, even though they had surveillance guys right there participating? Were you guys just kind of caught in the meat grinder of politics?
Well, I think eventually there might have been a component of that to it. That I find it incredibly difficult to believe with the level of sophistication going on that it was not just the Austin Regional Intelligence Center that's in those emails. It's the Houston Regional Intelligence Service Center and the Texas Fusion Center. Three fusion centers were in those emails. I find it very unlikely that Houston didn't know what was happening.
And yet you said yourself that they weren't sure what exactly was going to go down. It's like they were prepared for something, but that sort of implies that they weren't prepared for what was going to happen because they didn't know enough and they might have been ticked off.
Well, I mean, in the same way that Shannon said that he dropped his thumb drive in the gutter on the way to court, I feel like some information might certainly be missing from what we actually got. They inspected all the information, what they call in camera, before they gave it over to us. So they wanted to redact and take out bits and pieces that they thought
were
inappropriate.
In camera means that you're allowed to look at it, you're allowed to read it, but you can't copy it and you can't take notes about it.
Well, and that was just with the judge and with the DA from Houston. So it was the judge who was deciding. It wasn't my attorney and it wasn't ourselves who were looking at any of this stuff. It was them who were deciding what we were eventually gonna get. So in what we got, there are holes. But I find it very difficult to believe that they were actually not kind of like going full force on letting people know. I feel my suspicion is that Houston was more upset at the fact that Shannon spilled the beans at that dump. They had to deal with the fallout from that, and I think that's where Houston was basically upset.
I love this about spilling the beans on a double date. I mean, how dumb criminal can you get?
It's just hilarious. I mean, he might have been trying to show off. I don't know what was going on. But I think it was part of the follow through that was a little sloppy there, and I think that there might have been a little bit of political back and forth happening to kind of extend that to release the other names, to put out those emails, and kind of extend our kind of suffering or our kind of having to go back to Houston and deal with that stuff and face the potential of trial.
Yeah, you guys were commuting back and forth constantly because you live in Austin. You do anyway. I don't know about the other folks. And you had to constantly commute for this legal stuff. Now, you didn't actually have a lot of legal expenses because Greg was nice enough to do this essentially pro bono, right?
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
It still had to hurt.
What was that?
But it still had to hurt financially and emotionally, the stress.
Yeah, I mean, and we were raising funds here and there for court transcripts, other filing fees. So there was maybe like $500 to $700 that we raised independently and gave over to them. But then we were going out there ourselves. We were having to get time off from work, and it was a constant sort of thing where I had to say, you know, to my boss, like, okay, I gotta go, you know, at this time, and he's in time off, and that was about maybe once a month, maybe every other month at certain times, but they would just reset us, and I'll come back.
Legal
come back,
can become like an all-consuming aspect of your life, even if you're only going to court every month or two. It just becomes something that's constantly an umbrella over everything else you're doing.
Yeah, and it was a black cloud over my life for 14 months. I didn't know if I was going to wind up going to jail. And I knew at the same time that I had met somebody. I mean, I didn't know Eric until the day of the arrest and when we met in jail. But I knew somebody who was sitting in jail because of the complications that arose from that. I mean, the Austin PD, shortly after they let us out, it was like December the 23rd, and I went back home. I went to the Valley for Christmas, but the Austin PD came to my apartment and just camped out. They interviewed or they talked to, questioned my roommates about where I worked, what I drove, what I looked like, if I had tattoos, and they were just waiting for me to show back up. Like, I don't know what they were planning at that time, like what additional information they actually needed, but they certainly, like, it was intimidation.
Apologies. Let me interrupt. We have a caller on the line, Doug. How you doing, Doug? Where are you calling from?
Houston, Clear Lake area.
Hi. So what are your thoughts on this discussion?
Well, I got two questions. What the gentleman's just talking about right now, you know, where they camped out in his apartment and interviewed his roommate, even in completely non-political cases, you know, like a murder's committed, they fixate on the first suspect. I guess usually they're right. You know, the person they think is obviously guilty is guilty. You know, I'm talking like purely non-political, you know, murder or robbery, whatever. But when they're wrong, then you get this institutional thing where they don't want to admit they're wrong. They want to make a case, whether there's a case to be made or not. I mean, Clarence Bradley, Brandley, there'd be, you know, dozens of cases, you know, the whole Innocence Project. So that'd be one, you know, issue I'd lay on the table. And the other issue I think we kind of passed by, you're saying this Shannon guy, it seemed like he was doing genuine police work or what we on the progressive side would say, you know, doing some real human good. You know, he was working on the issue of human trafficking, which, you know, is a very serious issue and needs good, solid police work. But it seems like there was a, you know, the Austin Police Department made a decision to pull him off of that and kind of put him on this, what I'd call Mickey Mouse police work, where he's, you know, he's surveying, you know, a nonviolent organization. Okay, we may do civil disobedience, we may not. And I don't know, and then they're trying to make a case. You know, once again, you get into that thing, so that, you know, acting in the role of agent provocateur, but, you know, just the opportunity missed that this guy could have been doing some human good on the issue of human trafficking. And I guess those would be my two issues, and, you know, I'll you guys take it from there.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for calling, Doug.
You're welcome.
You know, I think Doug actually raises an interesting point about Shannon. Shannon is not a black and white character in this. He's really kind of gray. He has done really legitimate, important police work, outreach, and doing, some people would argue, necessary surveillance or infiltration to make sure that within a peaceful movement there aren't a couple of nut jobs who, like, want to throw bricks or set bombs, and then he ends up being the guy with the bricks. So something happened to Shannon somewhere in this process, and undercover work is a very, very freaky thing for cops. What are your thoughts on Doug's comments and on this schizophrenia that undercover cops have to work under that sometimes forces, I'm not going to say forces, that sometimes motivates them or causes them to go over a line?
So let me just clarify real quick. It was actually Deke Moore who was the human trafficking vice person. The other two, Shannon and Rick, were from narcotics. Everyone was from the organized crime division. Their immediate supervisor was in organized crime. So it was actually Deke. But still, the point is still valid, where he was doing good work. And why did they pull him off? And why did they have him in there so long? And after being in there so long and seeing that we weren't doing anything violent at all, why are they trying to make some noise? Why are they trying to, cause some trouble?
Yeah, to provoke. Quick ID, you're listening to KPT I do know my station. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. My guest is Ronnie Garza. Occupy Austin, Gulfport 7, social and political activist. And the call-in number is 713-526-5738 if you have anything you would like to ask or contribute to the discussion. So in your opinion, when is infiltration and or surveillance of a group, even an apparently peaceful group, justified? Even within a peaceful group, you occasionally have people that go a little crazy. The SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, I believe, was the origin of the Weathermen, who ended up planting bombs in the 1960s. And when the bomb goes off, the first thing people say is, why weren't the police aware of this? Where is the intelligence? So the police in that context are caught in a politically very challenging position. When should they be finding out, and what if something happens that they maybe should have known about if they had been doing some digging but didn't? And as someone who has been in the place where they were doing this intelligence gathering, what are your thoughts on that?
So I heard an interesting quote recently that espionage is the second oldest profession, that these sort of information gathering and spying activities is a really old kind of practice. So it's hard to think that it's going to just go away entirely, completely at some point. But I want to say that they were there for 3 months. Once they were there for so long and they recognized that there was nothing happening, I mean, you got to give a group some leeway. It's not like they're infiltrating any and all religious groups or other Tea Party groups all over the place, or any kind of people questioning the validity of laws.
Or are they?
Or are they? Right, exactly, with the NSA, or are they? But I think that at some point you just got to let people kind of like go on face value, because they knew. And it's more than that. To me, it's way more than that. It's not that they had to be there to kind of catch or intercept some sort of bad activity. They were pushing the activity, and we know now, once more information has come out, that there's been these links between big financial institutions and this coordinated crackdown on Occupy. It just seems, on the face of it, it just seems like they're trying to make a case to say these people, you know, don't listen to them, you know, don't listen to what they have to say about inequality. They're a bunch of crazy radicals and they're doing crazy stuff. But it's really not the case. They're looking to build something up against us.
Actually, I'm sorry, we have a time lag. You give me a great segue for my next question, which is coverage by media. I'm not going to specify whether it's mainstream or alternative or Fox, which is in a category almost of its own, but coverage by media. I remember when Occupy Wall Street first started, I believe for the first 2 weeks that literally Keith Olbermann on Countdown was, I believe, the only person on a major network or cable channel who was even talking about it. It took 2 weeks before any other news networks started to pay attention. On the other hand, in alternative media, so-called, you know, there were stories, there were blog posts, and this starts to raise a really fundamental question about how a news consumer can gather information. If you're going to dismiss apparently propaganda organ news organizations or bloggers. And if you're going to rely on so-called mainstream or reputable journalistic organizations, understanding that they have to make news choices about how many minutes or seconds they're going to give to a story, what they're going to cover, what has audio, what has video, what's newsworthy. What happens when the only place you can hear about a legitimate social movement is in, again, so-called alternative media? And, of course, the problem with alternative media is just the average person, in many cases, blogging, not necessarily having any journalistic standards, not necessarily having any objectivity or bias toward facts over opinion. It really leaves people, I think, with a serious information dilemma.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things that I'm really interested in studying in grad school, actually. I'm really interested in things like media economics, political psychology, the role of the news media in public opinion. It seems that the media is a pillar when it comes to its function within a democracy. And so if you have incomplete information, if you're missing large chunks of what's happening on the ground all over the place, then people aren't going to know. They aren't going to be aware of what is happening. I think one of the benefits of social media is multiple eyes. That things, even though they're coming from an individual blogger or something like that, if you have multiple people reporting on the same thing, if you have pictures from that location, then it really verifies what they're talking about. If you have pictures, you have video, and all that sort of stuff coming from a lot of different angles, that kind of like creates a peer review of sorts in and of itself.
I want to make a point. I'm sorry, but about pictures. Pictures are really, really important. You know, our media today, in terms of visuals, is often very sanitized. The most you'll get is, well, this is really graphic, you should send the kids out of the room. But usually they just don't show that stuff. And I can understand on one level why. But, you know, you go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire back around 1911 or 1912, I forget exactly when you had this fire in a sweatshop in New York City and the employers had locked all the doors so none of the young women there, mostly immigrant women, could take unauthorized breaks. And when a fire broke out on two or three floors of the building, women jumped out of the building in order to avoid being burned to death. This happens in fires in high-rises. And the thing that made the difference in how that story ended up being impactful was the photographs of all the bodies of all the women who had jumped laying on the sidewalk. It was horrific. They had pictures of the women in the makeshift morgue. They had, I mean, there was awful, awful pictorial evidence that basically created the modern union movement, because these women had died for no reason except, to put it in blunt and perhaps excessive terms, greed. These women had died for the sake of greed. So pictures, as you say, in social media, in an age when visuals are often sanitized, become a really critical component of emotional impact and then action.
Right. I totally agree. One of the things that actually impacted me really early on was back in high school, hearing about the role of images from the Vietnam War, that images that were coming back from the Vietnam War were part of what was fueling the backlash against that. And policies changed as to how, embedded journalists were able to report after that time. So I think that the role of public opinion and how it's shaped through the media is extremely important, especially in a democracy. People need to know the truth. People need to know what's happening. Otherwise, they can't respond. And a lot of times, they feel like they're alone. They feel like they're the only ones who think like this. You know, they don't see everyone else. They don't see the people on the ground doing, you know, X, Y, and Z, also fighting the same battles that they feel passionate about. And so I think that's really important. So social media plays a pretty important role. But it's still stifled because we're going through Facebook. I mean, we're going through these large corporations. We're going through Facebook. We're going through Twitter, and they're set up in these hierarchical kind of structures, and they have their own algorithms, and they control how that's doled out. So we still have progress to make, and we still need to make motions in the direction of making media more accessible and getting more points of view out on the stations that are already out there, the people who are progressive, the folks like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes and the rest of those
Lawrence stuff. O'Donnell.
They really need to be engaging with people who are in Occupy and who are organizing on a day-to-day basis. So, yeah, I totally agree with you there.
I also want to mention Kit O'Connell, who helped me get in touch with you, who does journalism for myfiredoglake.com and reports out of Austin, a gonzo journalist, self-described. And I appreciate his putting me in touch with you. You know, I have two sayings that I kind of like in the context of this show. The one that I use most often is, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And the other one is, an educated electorate is a prerequisite for democracy. And I think this gets back to public opinion, the communal choices that we make cannot be made appropriately. We have no hope of making them appropriately unless we have proper information and the education on which to build in order for people to grasp and analyze the information that they've got. We're about out of time now. Ronnie Garza of Occupy Austin and also other social and political activism, I very much appreciate your time and hearing your story. Anything you want to plug before we go, any sites or anything that you would like people to be able to access?
Well, certainly. So I am making a documentary. It's surveillanceeye.wordpress.com. You can also follow it on Twitter, @surveillanceeye. I'm very still involved in activism in Austin. We've been working with the Rise Up Texas group, who was fighting the anti-abortion legislation out at the Capitol over this summer. I have a lot of videos, actually documentary-type videos, of what was happening out at the Capitol on my YouTube page. It's shared, as well as the Surveillance Eye documentary footage. And one thing that I've been working on for a long time from Occupy is the Article5.org group and the Article 5 movement.
Okay, I'm going to have
group
to
of folks.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there. We're down to our last minute. I thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to ThinkWing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I have a blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also get it at thinkwing.org. You can follow me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. And thank you so much for listening. I will just point out that slower traffic really should keep right. It's not just a good idea. It is the law. Thank you so much for listening. I'll speak to you next week, same time, same station.
Heart in Harmony, an evening of acoustic and musical expression benefiting healthcare for the homeless, Houston, will feature Sarah Golden of NBC's The Voice, singer-songwriter Angelica McCutcheon, and pieces donated by more than a dozen artists. The event is Thursday, February 6th at Walters Downtown, 1120 Naylor Street, Houston, Texas, 77002. All proceeds support Healthcare for the Homeless Houston, a nonprofit charitable organization founded in 1999 whose mission is to promote health, hope, and dignity to Houston's homeless. To purchase tickets, for more information, and to preview the artwork before the event, you can visit homeless-healthcare.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org online.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I was couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul, you know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine. What I'm calling the Shock Doctrine is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
The following program may contain language or imagery that may be offensive to some listeners. Discretion is advised. The Federal Communications Commission permits the broadcast of some profanity during hours deemed to be safe harbor, when children are less likely to listen. KPFT upholds a stricter policy, permitting the broadcast of sensitive material only between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The FCC forbids the broadcast of some sexual discussions or